illicit sources. Right. What can we do with that?
That's a very good question. Well, the religious authorities have stated that it is allowed, it is permissible for a woman to receive whatever is given by her husband. And it's not necessary for her to investigate and to see whether the amount given to him was obtained or received from a halal source or not. Because, okay, let's assume that maybe 10% of a man's income is halal and the rest is maybe haram. Okay. Now, his wealth is mixed with halal and haram.
Right.
The money given to the wife is halal for her. She doesn't need to check to make sure that the money given to her is halal. Okay, whatever is given by the husband is halal. And this is the opinion of the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and Grand Ayatollah Sistani. They have said whatever is given by the husband to the wife is halal and she can use it.
Yes. Shastavi, there was an assumption that there is a mixture of halal and haram source
yes.
in the salary or gain of the husband. But what if the husband's, in fact, main source or all that the husband actually receives is from the theft or robbery? It's not mixed with anything else, which we call halal. It's always haram, right?
For the wife, it's permissible to receive and to use whatever is given by her husband. Even though she knows the husband commits theft, she earns haram money, but it's not necessary for her to find out whether the amount given to her is halal or haram.
I see.
Because it's not, she is wajibun nafaqa, and she is entitled to the money given to her. Okay, maybe the amount received by the man, maybe he received from another man that was haram for that man. So how can you find out that, okay, that money was basically haram or halal? Okay, the money is itself not to blame because it's a piece of paper
right.
given to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Sovit. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back momentarily after this break.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, what is the law or Islamic and Sharia law regarding women's fasting or the wife's fasting without the husband's consent?
If it does not violate the husband's rights, conjugal rights, it's okay. She does not need her husband's permission to observe fasting.
Right.
But okay, if the husband wants her to be available
right.
for the husband, for him, and she brings up an excuse telling him that I'm fasting, I cannot be available, that's a different issue. It's not permissible in that case for the wife to observe fast, and she must obtain her husband's permission. So depending on the scenario, depending on the condition, if it does not violate her husband's rights, legal and Sharia rights, then it's okay, she can fast without his permission.
I see. Okay, and what about actually the Sharia law regarding offering the prayer without mohr? We know that the Shia, school of thought requires people or Muslims, while they're offering their prayer, they have a piece of actually soil, usually, or something that they call mohr, right?
Yes,
piece. And yeah, a piece of clay,
yes.
Right? And then they, when they prostrate, they have to put their forehead on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
During prostration. So if any Muslim does it, or a Shia, for example, does it without the mohr, is his prayer valid?
Right. Well, generally speaking, it is necessary for a duty-bound person who offers prayers to do sajda on anything which is allowable.
Mm-hmm.
And anything which is part of the surface of the earth. It could be a piece of clay, and preferably a piece of clay obtained from the land of Karbala, from the earth surrounding the chamber of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Okay, but okay, anything which is considered to be part of the surface of the earth is allowed for prostration, like leaves of tree, like grass, like stones, like wood, cement, and
even cement.
Yes, of course.
Which is a processed one.
It's okay. It's part of the first. It's not mineral, okay? But what is forbidden is mineral like gold, like metals, like anything metals, okay?
Mm.
And then anything which is edible, like eating, you eat it. For example, vegetable which people eat, like chive, like leeks, like coriander. These are vegetables people eat. Okay?
What about the carpet?
Carpet, it's not permissible. It's not permissible because it's something people wear. People wear. Okay, if something is edible or wearable or something which is
the
mineral.
Carpets usually come from cotton and it's part of the earth. You said that the leaves and the branches and the trees are okay.
You're right,
the wood is okay.
Right.
But it's a piece. Actually, they weave the carpets with or via. It comes from that source. I mean, cotton.
If you are certain that it is pure cotton, it's
or
okay.
Wool.
No, wool is wearable.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now for example, sometimes there could be a situation in which you do not find any of these things which are allowable for sajda.
Okay,
so in that case, if you have a piece of paper. Or you have
a piece of cloth.
Handkerchief which is made of cotton,
uh-huh.
pure cotton.
Right.
You can prostrate on
it.
Yes.
Okay.
Otherwise, okay, things which you wear, you cannot do sajda on.
Right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, we know that sometimes when we are offering our prayer, we feel that there is still a little particle of food left in our mouth. What is the Islamic law regarding swallowing that edible particle?
Well, it is not considered to be eating something. Okay, so it is permissible to swallow those small particles of
right.
food or maybe drops of water left in your mouth during prayer.
Yes.
Because in common sense, it's not considered to be eating food or drinking water.
Yes.
So it's okay, and it will not affect your prayers.
Mm-hmm, I see. What is the Islamic law regarding a grandmother giving milk to her child?
Right. It's okay. It's permissible. And because the mahramiya is already there, right?
Right.
So the mother is absent and the child is crying. Okay, the child is hungry.
Right.
So the grandmother can breastfeed the child and it is okay. There's no problem whatsoever with regards to breastfeeding a child. And that's done by the grandmother.
I see. What about the...
Even women who are unrelated to the child,
yes,
they can breastfeed the child.
There's no problem.
No.
They become actually,
Mahram.
Yeah, mahram.
That's not... Mahramiya does not take place so easily, you know. If a child is breastfed for 15 consecutive times, mm-hmm, then that mahramiya is created, established.
And till the end of the life.
Yes, of course. Yeah, it's just like the child becomes like the woman's child.
Yes.
Okay, the woman's child, and then of course hijab is not required. Because she is the child is the child of that woman, and she is called the foster mother, the foster mother.
Okay,
and of course there are other details and conditions which
depends on different scenarios.
Yeah,
thank you very much, Sheikh. That was Sheikh Javed speaking with me and kindly providing answers to my Islamic questions regarding the jurisprudence based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو الوحيد القهار. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In a dramatic shift, the Trump administration has slashed crucial HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, risking millions of lives. Now, as billions of dollars in U.S. military assistance flow to the genocidal Israeli regime, why is Africa's health being sacrificed? Will the continent fight back and build its own future, or is it too late? Now, to help us unpack the move by Trump to cut HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, we are joined by two distinguished guests. First, we have Tahrir Hassan. Now, he is an executive member of the International Solidarity Movement for Africa and Palestine. We are also joined by Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze. He is an esteemed academician and chairman of the Global Pro-Life Alliance. Stay with us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we delve deep into this issue. In a shocking shift of priorities, the Trump administration has drastically slashed U.S. foreign aid, cutting HIV funding for Africa. U.S. AIDS 2024 budget for sub-Saharan Africa dropped significantly, affecting 25 million people in 2024. South Africa faces a loss of $427 million, putting over 500,000 lives at risk. Yet, despite these devastating cuts, the U.S. continues to funnel billions of dollars in military aid to the Israeli regime amid its ongoing genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Since October 7, 2023, the U.S. has spent more than $22 billion supporting the Israeli regime's war crimes. Now, what's more, Trump's rush to exploit Africa's rich deposits of rare earth minerals shows his administration's eagerness to extract the continent's resources while turning a blind eye to the health and well-being of its people. So how can the Trump administration justify such drastic reductions to health programs while prioritizing support for genocide in Gaza and resource extraction in Africa? Is this a clear message that African lives don't matter as much as geopolitical and economic gain? With Africa's future hanging in the balance, will the continent rise to build self-sustaining health systems?
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
The abrupt halt of the U.S. president's emergency plan for AIDS relief funding to South Africa threatens the country's fight against HIV, putting thousands of healthcare workers' jobs at risk and also disrupting treatment for millions of patients. However, South Africa's health minister says the move by President Trump is a much-needed wake-up call. Let's take a listen.
I want to regard this moment as a wake-up call, because whether we like it or not, it is the responsibility of every government to provide for its people. It's not the responsibility of other governments. I understand the issue of solidarity, but every government on this planet has got a responsibility to provide for its people. That's where it must start. Which means there must be very clear political will. Because I agree with Mama Winnie here, that this type of relationship where we depend on one country, and when the country is in some negative mood, the whole world collapses. Yes, it's scary. In fact, I was asking myself, how did we arrive here, where all of us depends on one country?
The U.S. has slashed funding for combating HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa, including significant cuts to South Africa's initiatives. While it is true Africans might have benefited from the funding, but there are always hidden benefits for the donors. Now, our first question goes to Fahriye Hassan. Now, in your opinion, What was the real reason behind U.S. funding the fight against HIV/AIDS in South Africa and other African countries?
Now, I have studied this quite intensely, and it turns out that much of this funding was designed in order to provide, I would say, it was mainly a United States foreign policy to give funding, but to impose certain directives on South Africa. You know, so while it did alleviate some of the epidemic and treatment on for people, the United States used to use this funding as leverage. I'll give you an example of this. So the Ministry of Health in South Africa would receive funding, but in order for them to receive the funding to treat the patients, they would have to provide the United States with, for instance, coal. They would have to provide them with certain raw materials. So it wasn't a, as I would say, a straightforward, giving money to South Africa as a aid in terms of aid. It was with strings attached.
Now, for a long time, Africa relied heavily on U.S. foreign aid for health programs, especially for combating HIV/AIDS. Please, Dr. Philip Njemanze, this for you. What's your take on the move by the U.S. to cut its assistance for Africa?
Might be distressing to some people, especially those people living with HIV. But on a systemic outlook, when you look at it as an expert, it's actually a welcome development. Because in the first place, foreign governments should not be investing directly into the health sector. Because what they do is that they cause a distortion of the health sector. The United States chose HIV, but that's not our priority. If you look at the epidemiology, HIV is far more less than diarrheal diseases. We could have probably chosen to fund diarrheal diseases where the money can be now put in provision of potable water. This will provide real development. When you put that money in HIV, this will go to the pharmaceutical companies who are still coming from the United States and other countries. So it leaves no developmental impact in Africa.
The U.S. is cutting billions in foreign aid to Africa, especially in health sectors, while continuing to allocate large sums to military support for Israel, despite its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Clearly, black lives don't matter for the U.S. and Israel.
First and foremost, in Africa, what is the role of Israel in Africa? And of course, the second part is, how does this impact on the genocide that Israel is perpetrating in Gaza at the moment? So what has happened is that Israel, as an entity, has imposed or as a foreign policy in Africa, whereby in conjunction with the Americans are obviously using the African command or AFRICOM in order to drive certain foreign policy directives. On the other hand, Israel has got a much more sinister need for their role in Africa. So what I'm trying to say is Africa, the role that Israel plays is a very nefarious role in that they exploit and even use slave labor from Africa in order to impose their will in order to carry out. And of course, the fact that the Palestinians, the Gazans, are not going into Israel, it has a major impact on their economy, you know. And as a result, this is what they've done. They've recruited slave labor from Africa in order to carry out their genocide in Gaza.
Trump's policies seem to prioritize military alliances over humanitarian aid. Now, the U.S. is giving military assistance to the Israeli apartheid regime and many African countries while cutting funding for critical health initiatives in Africa. Now, while the U.S. is cutting its health aid to Africa, its military aid is seen as a source of destabilization in the continent. Dr. Jemanze, do you agree with this?
We don't want the remilitarization of Africa. We don't want all the military games being played, AFRICOM and all the other ones coming up in the continent. Because all what they have done is to fuel internal violence in the country and cause mass distortions. You will see Boko Haram exploded, not because there were no Western presence. There is because there were a lot of Western military presence. So instead of violence to reduce, it actually increased.
Well, thanks for that. Let's take a short break before we continue our discussion on the move by the U.S. to cut its HIV/AIDS assistance to African countries. Stay with us.
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
Former President of Kenya Uhuru Kenyatta criticized African leaders who panicked over Trump's decision to halt foreign aid. Speaking at a health conference, Mr. Kenyatta said Africa should think of how to judicially use its available resources rather than relying on foreign assistance.
This is a wake-up call for you to say, okay, what are we going to do to help ourselves? Instead of crying... To Julize, what are we going to do? Aya, ametoa hiyo pesa, sasa tutafanya namna gani jameni? What are we going to do? Yeah? To support ourselves.
Now, in light of the US aid cuts, some leaders like we have seen Uhuru Kenyatta have argued that Africa should take greater responsibility for funding its own health programs, citing tax evasion and the looting of African resources by the same Western countries that provide the so-called aid to Africa. Now, Mr. Hassan, do you see these as an opportunity for Africa to move away from dependency on foreign aid and develop a more self-sufficient healthcare system?
I would like to bring in somebody by the name of Ibrahim Traore of Burkina Faso. I think what he's doing in his country has demonstrated that, yes, that Africa can indeed stand on its own feet. And why am I using Burkina Faso as an example? Because one of the things that had plagued the African continent and various countries has been terrorism. It has now come to light, given the Department of Government Efficiency run by Elon Musk, revelations about the role of U.S. aid in Africa, and that much of that aid has been going to terrorists, you know, funding of Boko Haram, funding of Al-Qaeda, and so on. What Ibrahim Traore has done, he was able to use his power as the president of the country in order to rid the country of much of the terrorists. What then happened was, as they pushed out the French and the terror groupings, they were able to take over much of the mining industry, the gold and uranium and platinum mining industry and so on. And with the result that funding is now coming into the fiscus of the government. And Ibrahim Traore has shown, I mean, he's built something like 50 or 60 schools, new schools. He's built many hospitals, road infrastructure. He's built ports, you know, his road infrastructure, his bridges, and so on, etc., giving people access to more. He's upgraded the agriculture and so on. So this is clear evidence that if Africa can rid itself from Western domination and the colonialist past, and of course. Now it's out in the open that it was the West that has been funding these terrorists. Africa would be able to become very prosperous if they are able to use their own resources.
South Africa's government has vowed not to let the U.S.'s withdrawal of $427 million in HIV/AIDS support collapse its programs which are among the largest in the world. Experts say that other African countries should follow suit in building more sustainable, self-reliant health systems in response to foreign aid reductions.
The actions by the South African government was in the interest of the South Africa. And the Nigerian government, after the withdrawal of the aid, took up the responsibility of providing drugs and the necessary things to people living with HIV/AIDS. These are welcome. That's the way it should be from the beginning. So African countries, we want to get the prevailing atmosphere in Africa is we don't need this aid. Don't give us any aid. Come if you, we want fair trade and we will trade with anyone. You can't dictate to us whether we will trade with this country or that country. No, we want fair deal. If it's gold you are interested in, there is a market price. It's a fair market price. Buy it at that. You can't buy it at 80 cents and sell it at 200 euros. And then tell us that you turn around and give us 10 billion in aid. We could have gotten that money ourselves from the minerals, far more, maybe 20 times more. So we don't, this whole attitude that Africa is a continent that has to be helped with aid is just nonsense, and we don't want any of it again.
While Trump met African leaders amid plans to extract critical minerals from the continent, he simultaneously slashed U.S. aid assistance for African health programs. Dr. Jemanze, how do you interpret this contradiction that while Trump is eager to tap into Africa's mineral wealth, he seems indifferent to the lives of Africans, as evidenced by the deep cuts to life-saving aid like HIV support?
Well, once it comes to the actions of President Trump, he, I think, is guided by the best interest of the United States, as far as they see it. And we should be guided by our own best interest. As I have said before, we do not need Western or any other person's aid. What we need is fair trade. If he's negotiating with African presidents and say, okay, we're interested in your minerals, not to come here for extraction, we want to buy it at the international market, fine. We are open for business. We tell you the price. The price is the international price, market price. You pay for it and you take it. So, and that should be our attitude.
Well, there you have it. For Africa to develop and cut aid dependency, it should benefit from its own minerals and should not let countries such as the U.S. continue looting the continent's resources. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mr. Fahri Hassan and Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze, for their incisive analysis.
Hello, I am Jannat Ali, and welcome to a new series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Carthage civilization. Founded by the Phoenician settlers from around Tyre, 814 BCE, Carthage was located in present-day Tunisia. The city's strategic location on the Mediterranean coast facilitated trade and naval dominance, making it one of the wealthiest cities in the ancient world by the 4th century BCE. Carthage controlled territories across North Africa, southern Iberia, and several Mediterranean islands. Carthage's rise to power was marked by its maritime capabilities, extensive trade networks, and a formidable navy. The city's economy thrived on trading goods such as gold, silver, ivory, and textile. Carthage also developed a complex political system with a powerful ruling elite and a strong military composed of mercenaries from various regions. However, Carthage's prosperity eventually led to the conflict with the Roman Republic. The two powers clashed in a series of wars known as the Punic Wars between 264 and 146 BCE. Despite the famous exploits of General Hannibal, Carthage ultimately lost to Rome. The Third Punic War between 149 and 146 BCE ended with the complete destruction of the Carthage by the Romans. The city was razed and the territory annexed. The Romans later rebuilt Carthage, making it an important center of the Roman Empire. Today, the ruins of Carthage are a UNESCO World Heritage Site, preserving the remnants of this once great civilization. Notable structures include the Byrissa Hill, the Antonine Baths, and the Punic Port, all maintained as part of the Carthage National Archaeological Park. That was a brief description of the Carthage civilization. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآن جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآن.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we're joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, brother Mahdi. Thank you for having me, and assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of several Quranic parts. First, Brother Muhammad is going to talk about the music or the musical miracle of the Noble Quran. Then, we all are going to listen to a recitation by a famous reciter of the Noble Quran. And at the end, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation from different aspects. Stay tuned.
إن هذا القرآن الذي جل فيه.
Well, today, as always, in the first part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, Brother Muhammad will talk about the miraculous music of the Noble Quran. Brother Muhammad, let's continue our beautiful discussion.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And today's program, we're going to talk about different aspects of actually the miraculous music of the Quran, or we could say the musical miracle of the Holy Quran. As we said, some words, they give the impression of that meaning just by the way that we pronounce those words.
Like, إِذَا زُلْزِلَتِ الْأَرْضُ.
Zilzala. That's one. There are many other examples.
The Zai, which resembles
not just
vibration
that.
And earthquake.
Actually, I meant something else. The word, the way that we want to pronounce it, it has a certain kind of feeling, certain kind of, state. For example, it has a state of caution. It has a state of fear. It has a state of khushur, humility, and so on and so forth.
Without knowing the meaning, you mean?
Yeah, without knowing the meaning. Exactly. This is the point. So, one example is Surah Al-Qasas. When Prophet Moses, he went to defend his follower who was fighting against an Egyptian, one of the men of Pharaoh. He went to his aid. He punched him and he died.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the people of, Egypt, the bad people, the people of Pharaoh, they found out that Moses had done such a thing, and the news spread really quickly. And they were trying to find Moses so they could kill him. Okay. Because they killed him. I think that person was a really important person. That's why they wanted to kill him. So the Quran says, فَأَصْبَحَ فِي الْمَدِينَةِ خَائِفًا يَتَرَقَّبَ. The word يَتَرَقَّبَ has a kind of caution in it. When we want to pronounce يَتَرَقَّبَ, we pronounce it with caution. We pronounce it cautiously. Why? Because we have two letters of تَرْقِيق, one letter of ra with tafkhim, and then a qaf with tashdeed, with shatta and tafkhim. We have to, we have to pronounce it deliberately, with caution. Mm-hmm. And so yataraqqab itself means that he was in the city, he was wandering around in the city with caution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was cautious.
That's right.
Okay. So that's the meaning itself. Another thing, another aspect of the music of the Quran is that the words, they are very much in harmony with each other. The meaning of the words are harmonious.
They're connected to each other, you mean?
With one another in terms of meaning. One example is in Surah An-Najm. وَالنَّجْمِ إِذَا هَوَى مَا ضَلَّ صَاحِبُكُمْ وَمَا غَوَى وَمَا يَنْطِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَى. We could see three words. All three of them, they share two letters, waw and ya. Only the first letter is different. Actually, hawa and hawa, the first hawa and the second hawa, it's the same word, but it has two meanings. Okay, the first hawa, wa najmi idha hawa, it talks about the star that, it descends. Hawa here means to descend, okay?
It's a verb, actually.
Yeah. So all of them are verbs.
Ma
dalla sahibukum wa ma ghawa. Your companion, which means the prophet, he was not misled, and he is not, a person who follows his own desires, okay, or mm-hmm. is a corrupt person, the ghawa. And وَمَا يَنْطِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَى. This time, hawa means carnal desire, to act based on your own carnal desires. وَمَا يَنْطِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَى. He does not speak something,
And this hawa is a noun.
Based on his own desire, yeah.
This hawa is a noun, actually.
Yes, this hawa. You were right. Not all three of them are not verbs. The first one is a verb, وَنَّجْمِ ذَا هَوَى. The second hawa, وَمَا يَنْطِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَى, is a noun, and it means carnal desire. Okay, and of course, the next verse says, إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَى. Whatever the prophet says is revelation and is the truth.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, now, in the second part of the program, let's recite the Quran.
We're going to listen to a recitation by Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. He's going to recite verses 16 to 21 of Surah Maryam. Dear audience, let's enjoy it.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa'kur fil kitabi Maryama idhin tabadat min ahliha makana shawqiya fattakhadhat min dunihim hijaban fa'arsalna ilayha
Dear audience, you just listened to the recitation of verses 16 to 21 of Surah Maryam, recited by Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, in these verses of Surah Maryam, we have the story of Lady Mary, peace be upon her. And Mustafa Ismail, he very beautifully, he tells this story. And his tone and his intonation and the register that he uses, the maqam which he's reciting in, is very appropriate for conveying the meanings of these verses. For example, when Mary says, "A'udhu bir-Rahmani minka in kunta taqiya," I seek refuge from the beneficent if you are God-wary. The angel says, he reads this with jawab al-jawab. قَالَ إِنَّمَا أَنَا رَسُولُ رَبِّكِ لَا لِأَهَبَ لَكِ غُلَامًا زَكِيًّا. When he reaches the part, لِأَهَبَ لَكِ غُلَامًا زَكِيًّا, he brings down his voice. The angel wants to console her.
Yeah, to make her
sympathize with her, you know, to calm her down. Yeah. Okay? لِأَهَبَ لَكِ غُلَامًا زَكِيًّا. So he goes up to the jawab al-jawab and slowly descends until the end of the verse. When Mary wants to say, how can I have a boy? How can I have a son when no human being has touched me? Again, he uses jawab al-jawab because she's frightened. She is surprised of such a thing. It seems impossible to her.
Yes.
Maybe
to show the anxiety, actually.
The anxiety, the fear, exactly. Then the angel answers her and says that this is what your God has desired, and it will definitely happen. And he's going to be a sign for the mankind. He's going to be a sign for mankind, and also mercy from us, right? Mercy from God. Anyway, so now let's talk about the tajweed.
Good idea, brother.
In the first few verses, we have a lot of ra's with sukun preceded by fatha.
So all of them
have tafkhim.
Yes.
Now, other than the tafkhim, which means we have to pronounce these ra's with thickness.
That's right.
Is the fact that ra should be pronounced without qalqala, and with tawassut. So,
compared to the plosives and weak fricatives, yeah. Actually.
Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, he pronounces all of them correctly. He doesn't say Maryam. Maryam. Fa'arsalna ilayha. Okay?
Yeah, the timing should be in between letters of plosive letters and weak fricatives,
yes.
Actually.
Wadhkur fil kitabi Maryam. إذن تبذت من أهلها مكانا شرقية again شرقية. Another issue is we have a lot of إخفاز. قالت إني أعوذ بالرحمن منك. We have a nun sakina followed by the letter kaf.
منك becomes منك.
Now there are two ways that we can apply إخفاء here. We could either apply it in the original way, which is approximating the place of articulation of the letter after the nun sakina, which is kaf, or we could actually place the tongue in the place of articulation of kaf. Both are acceptable. In fact, the second way of doing it is a lot easier.
Yes.
The way that Mustafa Ismail, he does the ikhfa. Minka. Instead of saying minka, he says minka. Both are correct.
In case we have kaf and qaf.
And qaf, exactly. In kunta. Kunta. Again, we have ikhfa, but this time you have to approximate the ta.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to place the tongue in the place of articulation of ta.
Okay.
Another important thing is whenever ya is mushaddad. Whenever ya is mushaddad by itself, and it is not the result of idgham of nun sakina, you have to make sure that the ya is not pronounced with too much intensity.
And without ghunna, actually.
Without
ghunna,
exactly. So if you say, قَالَ كَذَلِكِ قَالَ رَبُّكِ هُوَ عَلَيَّ هَيِّن. Is that correct?
No.
عَلَيَّ هَيِّن.
That is too tense, I think.
Yeah. We don't need this much intensity. قَالَ كَذَلِكِ قَالَ رَبُّكِ هُوَ عَلَيَّ هَيِّن.
It should be soft.
Yes, it should be soft, just like the way that Sheikh Mustafa Ismail reads the ya with tashdeed.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان
الأشواق وفيه محاسن الأخلاق والقرآن.
Suffering within, this is the love has dyed me in blood. Lord, I'm wise, neither mad. Your love caused me all the joy, took my heart and made fond of it. Desired to kill. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and what love has done to me, got me deeply involved in this pain. Now and then, like the winds I blow. Now and then, like the roads I go. Now and then, like the floods I flow. I'm Yunus, mystic of sorrow, suffering wounds from top to toe. In the hands of beloved, I write in woe. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deep involved in this pain. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain.
Have a good time. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always